Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon and I today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And this week, mark your card for May. With sticky inflation, the latest figures were out this week, there's more pressure on the Bank of England to raise interest rates. But it's not all bad news. More pay, slower house prices, better savings deals. Simon looks on the bright side, saying that though, do watch out if you're on a variable rate mortgage, this really is it for cheapo deals. Nope, really, I know I've been saying this for a while, but this is it. Also today, watch out for the new car tax ban set to bite from April. Good news for cohabiting couples, and Rachel helps us stay warm and solvent. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Enjoy peace of mind with our new guaranteed income bonds and guaranteed growth bonds.
We've had lots of noise over the past couple of weeks, haven't we, about a possible rate rise. The idea that they'd need to go up earlier and by a somewhat greater extent, as suggested by the Bank of England, was only firmed up by higher than expected inflation figures out a few days ago. Now, the first rise is still expected in May. There will be winners and losers who've got used to an era of cheap money. Simon, though, ever the optimist, we'll get to that shortly. But first, for those who aren't economists, i.e. me, interest rates, currently 0.5%, could go up 25 basis points, don't ask, in a few months. Inflation, don't even get me started on CPI, RPI. CPIH, that's stuck at 3%. Some thought it would drop 2.9%. 0.1% apparently makes a big difference. Wage growth is at 2.6%, expected to rise 3.1% this year. Though hands up who's had a pay rise. I'm going to pick on you, Rachel. Speak for every man and woman for who these figures will go straight over their heads but may hit them hard in the pocket. How they all link together?
It is annoying because it sounds utterly convoluted and there are so many different numbers. And if you hear these headlines on the news and you read about them, it's very easy to think, what on earth has that got to do with me? But it's annoyingly not that simple because those numbers affect things like how much money we've got, what rate we get on our savings, how much we pay for our mortgage. So it's worth, I think, keeping a rough look at what's going on. You can start with any of them because it's all so cyclical. So we'll start arbitrarily with inflation. So the Bank of England's main job is to keep inflation in check.
Lots of price of stuff, right?
The price of stuff. So it doesn't want the price of stuff to go up too quickly. It doesn't want it to slow down either. It kind of makes sense. It affects whether you want to buy things now or later. You don't want people to get ahead of themselves. So what do they do to keep inflation in check? They want it at 2%. That's their target, which I like to think of as, you know, those lines on the underground, the yellow ones. You could stand slightly front of them and you'd probably be all right. But the yellow line is the point at which if you stand behind that, guaranteed 100% safe. And it's kind of like that with 2% inflation. You could probably...
But if you stand too far back, you're not going to get a seat. To use the analogy, I mean, could it go...
Because
if it goes really low, then that's bad as well.
That's bad as well. It's like targeting no inflation at all, but just being a little bit safer, because the thing that everyone hates is deflation. So the Bank of England has to target inflation. What's its main tool to do that? It's got a bunch of stuff, but its favourite is interest rates. That's the kind of lever that it can pull either way to determine what the inflation rate is. The level that it sets it at is determined by going around, talking to businesses, looking at all of these sorts of figures that we were just talking about and working out what the economy can stomach. If it starts to raise interest rates at a faster pace, what's going to happen? Are people going to struggle to pay their debts? Is that going to be a problem? What will happen to wage growth? So it looks at all these different things and decides what the interest rate is going to be. Where does pay fit in? Pay is an interesting one because what tends to happen is as the price of stuff, inflation goes up, people say, well, hang on a minute, I'm going to need more money to deal with that. And so you can end up with that kind of building momentum. So people are demanding higher wages, which means that the costs for businesses goes up, which means that they then have to pass on those costs to their customers. And so it perpetuates. People need more money to pay for the higher costs, and it goes round and round.
Surely, Bank of England raises interest rates, then you raise wages, and so you've got more money to buy more stuff, and then those businesses go, well, everybody's got more money, and things are costing us more, so let's just put up the price of stuff even more.
So what you have to understand, what you have to look at, really, is why would you raise interest rates? And what happens when you borrow money from a bank? The chief element of this is, for example, when you borrow a mortgage from the bank, is the bank does not take money that it already has and then lend you the money for the mortgage. The bank, at some point, presses a key on a computer and it creates the money that goes into your mortgage. It literally just creates it. And what affects the demand on the mortgages is the rate of interest. So if the cost of borrowing on that mortgage is 2%, then a certain number of people will go, okay, mortgage at 2%, I could afford that. I can pass all the checks and things that need to be done to get me my mortgage at 2%. I'll borrow that mortgage at 2% and I'll move home. I'll borrow some more money, I'll move up the ladder, I'll become a first-time buyer, I'll do all these various things. But if the price of that mortgage is 2.5%, then lots of people will still be able to afford the mortgage. If they need to move for some reason, they might still be able to move. But they'll be able to borrow a little bit less because it will be more expensive. They might be less likely to pass those affordability checks, and it dampens the demand for it. So there will be a chunk of people who could have borrowed at 2% but can't borrow at 2.5%. And so it takes down the demand for it, which means that the banks create less money. So there's less money being created. And the more money that's created, the greater the level of inflation is. So the Bank of England, the idea behind it raising interest rates is to stall that. And there are also elements where the supply of creating that money is restricted to the banks because they have to retain a certain amount of capital. But what's been interesting, obviously, in recent years is the fact that interest rates have been so low, and they've been so low for so long. And one of the reasons why interest rates were so low for so long is because we were trying to recover from the financial crisis and combat the threat of deflation. And you wouldn't have to go back that far on the This Is Money podcast to find us talking about the Bank of England being worried about deflation. Mm. Now we've got a little bit of inflation, and all of a sudden we're really, really worried about inflation. And so it's talking about putting up rates. But really, it's just getting the rates off the floor, off that emergency level. And if you look at the inflation report last week, the Bank of England goes into an insane amount of detail in quite complicated terms on some of these things. But it has a passage that says domestic cost pressures. Once the transitory effects from the fall in sterling have passed through and the absence of further external cost shocks, CPI inflation will be mainly determined by domestic inflationary pressures. What does that mean? After the Brexit vote, the pound fell in value against other currencies. We import lots of stuff, and that pushed up the price of lots of the things that we buy. Therefore, the cost of that basket of goods went up. Now that that fall is going to go out of the equation because the pound isn't continuing to drop, it's stabilised, inflation is going to be mainly affected by stuff that happens in the UK economy, not these external shocks. And then it goes on to say the cost of labour, and in particular wages, is the largest domestic cost facing most companies, and hence is a significant driver of domestic inflationary pressures. So as Rachel was explaining, companies have to pay people wages, and if people's wages are going up faster, they have to charge more for their goods in order to pay for it and to maintain their profits. But crucially, wage growth has been super, super low. It's been falling in real terms, so once adjusted for inflation, since the financial crisis. And there hasn't been a lot of pressure on this. And if you look at the average from 1998 to 2007, the Bank of England inflation report shows that the average wage growth over that period was 4.3%. Since the financial crisis, it's been about 2 to 2.5%. And what that means for people in real life is that if you are not promoted or moving jobs, you've been losing money. So that's really the only way that people have been getting above inflation pay rises is to either get promoted at work or to move jobs. And so I think this is why we can probably afford to be quite relaxed about wage increases, because this idea of the wage price spiral is textbook economic stuff, but that's based on normal circumstances. And I think that we can look at it and go, we are definitely not in normal circumstances. So if people's wages suddenly start going up by a bit above inflation, all they're doing is regaining some of the ground that they've been losing for the best part of a decade.
If wages, though, Rachel, have been so low, and that's been a bit of a puzzle, particularly for economists, why now Are they going to suddenly go up? Especially when, and we mentioned this last week, so do listen back to last week, so we won't go too much detail, but especially when we've got the B word on the horizon, Brexit.
We absolutely can't be sure. It hasn't gone, as Simon said, how the textbooks say that it ought for many years now. So what is supposed to happen is when employment rates reach these heady levels that they've been at for the last few years, then employers are supposed to have to entice you to keep you or to entice you from other employers by offering you higher wages. That just hasn't happened, which is precisely what is supposed to happen. The Bank of England has been saying for years now, it's coming, it's coming. They talk about the slack in the labour market disappearing. And once you've got rid of that slack, the only possible thing to happen is that wages will have to go up. And it hasn't. One thing that may make a difference, though, over the next year, the minimum wage has gone up, and that will force employers to pay their lowest employees more money. When you see these wonderful headlines saying best pay rise since I don't know how long, but it was about 2.5% last year, which is rubbish when inflation is much more. This year, there are predictions of around 3%, which is, it sounds much better. But this won't be everyone. This is not some kind of consensus decision that everyone should get more money. A lot of it will be driven, which is great, by lower earners and different pockets in the workforce where there is more pressure. If there are sectors where there are lots of potential employees and fewer jobs, journalism, for example, you may not see that kind of level of wage growth. In other areas where there is more demand, specialisms that are sprouting up where there aren't yet the levels of people with the expertise that are required, then there might be wage growth, but don't think that it's going to be everyone.
And I think that wages, we talk about a lot of things in terms of personal finances, governments, policymakers, think tanks, the endless supply of, you know, information and thought leadership and research and things coming out. I don't think we talk about wages anywhere near enough. So wages are fundamentally pretty much the most important element of people's day-to-day wealth, unless they are retired. And we don't think about how we're going to get this problem solved. So the Bank of England, for example, this is not the Bank of England's problem to deal with. This is not the Monetary Policy Committee's problem to deal with. The Monetary Policy Committee has a very narrow remit, which is basically to maintain price stability, and it targets inflation of 2%. And there is an argument that actually that target should move around a bit, that we shouldn't be targeting 2% at the moment because we've got these external shocks, and also to promote the government's economic, you know, strategy to stability and growth. But it's the government's job to be doing some stuff on this, be looking at why people's wages haven't gone up over the last 10 years, why productivity has stalled. And what productivity means in simple terms is the way businesses make more money is by managing to do more stuff with the same amount of effort. And they can do that in two ways, either by investing in their staff and improving their skills, or investing in their business, for example, new machinery, new tools, that means that their staff can do more work in the same amount of time. The way you don't increase productivity in a meaningful way is just by making people do more work for the same amount of money, which is pretty much what we've been doing for the past 10 years. And instead of the government coming up with any real innovative thinking or ideas on how to deal with this, there's been a little bit of tinkering around the edges. So we've increased the minimum wage, which is great. We've taken a lot of low earners out of tax, out of paying income tax. But what are we doing about those people who aren't getting a pay rise because they're not the people with the sharp elbows either getting promoted or moving jobs? What are we doing about the people who are working in the Sports Direct warehouse and who are just entirely reliant upon that kind of thing?
Are we doing anything?
No, we're not really doing anything about it. So what can we do about that? Well, firstly, we could encourage people to develop their skills. Why don't we bring in a system whereby people can opt to use some of their income before tax, for example, or get some form of government help to get some career coaching to help increase their skills, to develop them up the ladder? Why aren't we looking at companies that are really good at taking people who work in what are considered to be unskilled or lower skilled jobs where they're lower paid and moving them up the ladder? And those companies do exist. So to give one example, McDonald's. McDonald's is phenomenally good at taking people up the career ladder. And it has been for many, many years. Where's the ministers coming out and talking about this kind of stuff? Where's the policy thought on how do we get the people in our economy into a position where they can get paid more money rather than just relying on productivity coming back or relying on companies eventually paying them more money. Because what we're drifting into is a two-tier society, the educated people at the top, and then you've got this big chunk of people at the bottom who are entirely dependent on whether their employer feels like giving them a pay rise, and they're not getting the skills developed that they need. And we're failing to come up with any ideas to deal with this.
I had promised that you'd be looking on the bright side in this episode.
Oh, but to look on the bright side,
right,
okay,
good,
here's
good.
The looking on the bright side.
Yep.
Things are getting better.
Excellent.
People's wages are going up. And we are talking about wages. And actually, if we just applied ourselves to thinking about it properly, it's quite clear that there are actually some easy gains to be made that would mean that people got paid more money. It's not like there aren't the opportunities out there. There is stuff we can do about it. We just need to actually bother.
I like this interpretation of optimism. So little has been done thus far that there's so much room for improvement, and that's the positive. I read this brilliant book last year by Andrew Scott and Linda Grattan about how to prepare for a 100-year life.
I read that too.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it talks a lot about how the kind of whole life cycle of education, work, retirement is changing and will have to change even further.
No longer a three-stage process, is it? And it's a lot more about your networks and gap years later on in life.
Precisely.
And we're working longer, we need multiple types of jobs, etc. Yeah.
So the notion that you can go to university or school and learn the skills that you will require for a career that's likely to span, what, it could be 60, 70
yeah.
years? That you could learn all of that within the first few years and then go out and do this job that's mm-hmm. going to be the same job that you start when you're 20 and you finish when you're 70-something is preposterous. And the notion that you could manage to sustain yourself in the same kind of occupation for that long,
when
it's not going to happen.
Include robots,
I mean, jobs,
and the like.
Lots of the things that we're doing now won't exist in another 30 years, and then there'll be a whole bunch of other stuff that we need to be prepared for. But we're not really thinking in that way about investing in our careers and developing ourselves at different stages, retirement in the right kind of way. I mean, people are going to get a huge shock, I think, when they expect that they're going to retire at the same age as their parents or that they've seen their grandparents retire at. But the whole thing needs a huge rethink in terms of how we think about work, how we think about preparing our workforce for the kinds of, Simon would look at it as opportunities, others might see it as struggles with automation and things changing around. And if we can kind of get to grips with that now and think in a savvy way about it, maybe we won't be looking in 20 years' time and looking at these same kind of productivity puzzles that we talk about because we haven't invested, we haven't thought about what we need our workforce to look like.
But you say all this big blue sky thinking. Wouldn't it be great in terms of work, housing, everything basically, infrastructure? Do we have that capability to do that kind of all-encompassing, cross-party, business involved, everybody getting involved, thinking about stuff and
well,
then doing?
We do have a bit of an issue where anybody who does come up with any form of innovative idea immediately gets shouted down. And we do have a particularly sharp political dividing line going on. However, I think that these are concerns that are shared by people across the political divide, whether you are New Labour, momentum-driven Labour, or a Tory, then you probably have a certain amount of concern for the fact that lower-paid people don't appear to be doing too well, and that's not doing the country much good. So it's not like there isn't the incentive there to do something about it. And we've seen the Brexit vote. We've seen a backlash against this stuff in terms of people not doing very well. You know, some people are doing very well, and then lots of people aren't doing very well at all. Mm. There is the impetus to act, and I'm sure we can act. We are actually quite sharp and quite clever and quite innovative in this country. There's lots of things that we can do. But looking on the how does raising interest rates help this scenario, perceived wisdom would be that raising interest rates would be a terrible thing to do in this kind of scenario where you're trying to do all of this stuff. But I think what we need to look at is we've had very, very low interest rates for the last decade, and we've developed all of these problems. So I think we can probably work on the basis that super low interest rates aren't helping any of this stuff, and that maybe raising interest rates might actually be beneficial. So, for example, there's lots of people in this country who do have money, but they're not spending it. if you raise interest rates and they're getting a bit of a better return on their savings, or they're getting a bit of a better pension income, and so on, they might start to feel a bit richer and they might start to spend a bit more money. You also have the scenario where raising interest rates has the benefit of slowing down the ability of people to keep paying more and more money for properties. Mm. So house prices start to slow, which is good news. And in fact, at the moment, house prices, if you look at across all of the surveys, are now rising by less than inflation and less than wages. So they are actually getting marginally cheaper. And if the reason why you're raising interest rates is because wages are going up, which means actually people are getting paid a bit more money, well, that world doesn't look too bad, does it? And also the other advantage is, as we talked about last week, we're going to have a recession sooner or later. So it might be an idea to be above the original emergency level before we get that recession.
Yes, well, we'll stick with a couple more optimistic green shoots and the like. Savers, you mentioned them there. We got reports this week, didn't we, Rachel? One-year bonds now paying 1.95%. But, you know, it shows signs in the right direction, but a lot of that's got to do with challenges. Is that right, as opposed to the idea that interest rates are going to go up?
It's both. I mean, banks and building societies will only pay you to hold your savings as much as they have to. And so if there's a lot of competition in the market, they have to pay you more to entice you from their competition. So yes, that does drive it. But rates have started to go up just a little bit the last few months. And another rise in the interest rate could nudge them just a tiny bit further. Still, though, if we're talking about inflation at 3%, that means that anything less than that, your money that you're sitting and prudently saving and your lovely nest egg is being eroded. So you can't get excited yet.
There are even signs, though, whether or not this year, that annuity rates could be on the up.
We have to kind of put it in the context of where they are now. They are so pitiful that, yes, they've gone up a little bit, and maybe they will go up a little bit more, but they'll be nowhere near the level that they were around about 8 years ago, enough to entice people to them. And the other problem that we have is pension freedoms, which is the ability to do whatever you like with your pension pot rather than being forced to convert your pot into an annuity. And that means that most people decide not to bother. A lot of the annuity providers are just sort of dropping out of the market. So there's a lot less competition. And that's not good if you are one of the few people who want an annuity. There are less people fighting for your custom. And so I don't think that we're going to see a massive rise in annuity rates anytime soon.
And just for every yin, there is yang, of course, winners and losers. Those on variable rate mortgages will be hit if a rise does come in May. The advice is to act now because we're seeing some of the top mortgage rates, well, we've been saying this for some time, haven't we, but disappearing. Is that the case?
Yes. Every time there is an indication that the Bank of England might think about raising interest rates, or might even think about raising interest rates, then mortgage lenders start to pull some of their best rates. And that reflects two things. One, the money markets kind of shift up. The bank says, we think interest rates are going to rise like this. And everybody looks at what they've said in the report. They basically agree with the expected path for interest rates. If that expected path for interest rates is higher than it was the previous inflation report, the money markets then decide that interest rates are going to rise even faster than what the bank said. And then economists say, yeah, we think interest rates are going to go up. So now we've got most economists saying that they think interest rates will go up in May, which obviously encourages the money markets to shift things forward. That affects lenders' costs of funding their mortgages. Long story, but that means that lenders maybe raise the rates a little bit because it's costing them a little bit more money to get some of that money in that they need to use to fund their mortgages. But also what they do is do it because they can. Right. Because when there are more people looking to get a mortgage now or to remortgage because they think that they need to get in quick before rates go up, lenders can obviously charge a bit more money and make a bit more money. So rates have gone up slightly and they will go up a bit more. What we saw, interestingly, when interest rates actually went up in November was that mortgage rates barely moved at all because all of the lenders had raised their interest rates before the rate decision came. So it's probably in the next few months, right, if we do get a May rise, that they'll go up, not after May. The people it affects, variable rate mortgages, if you're on a tracker rate mortgage, your rate will go up automatically. And if you're on a tracker rate mortgage, you've been willing to take the gamble that you know rates might go up and your mortgage rate might go up. If you're on your lender's standard variable rate, they could raise it by as much as the Bank of England raises. They could raise it by less, by more. It's up to them. If you are on your lender's standard variable rate and you're not on one of these wonderful deals that you got locked into before the financial crisis, you should probably be looking at getting a new mortgage anyway, because standard variable rates are quite expensive. They're around 4 to 5%. And new fixed rate mortgages or new tracker rate mortgages are considerably cheaper than that. The good news, though, in the Things Can Only Get Better edition of
Excellent.
The podcast,
yep.
is that even though interest rates on mortgages have moved up, mortgages are really cheap.
In Simon's hand is a ripped out piece of a notepad with lots of numbers on it. Simon, what do those numbers say? I can't wait.
Right. So if you were to take Britain's most popular mortgage, the 2-year fixed rate, which I don't know whether I would do because at the end of those 2 years, interest rates are probably going to be higher. Mm. And 2 years passes pretty quick and you probably won't move in 2 years. But if you did do that and you were fortunate enough to have 40% equity in your home, so you're borrowing at 60% loan to value, you could get an interest rate of 1.19% on your mortgage. If you borrowed at 75% loan to value, you could get an interest rate of 1.24% on your mortgage. And if you borrowed a 10% deposit, 90% loan to value, 1.83% on your mortgage. That's amazing. Mm. 10% deposit and you can get a mortgage at 1.83%. I mean, that is cheap.
That's for 2 years, though.
That's
isn't
for
it?
2 years. Yeah. But look at 5 years. If you've got a 10% deposit, so 90% loan to value, you could borrow at 2.29%. That's below the rate of inflation.
Yeah.
That's even below the rate at which people's wages are going up. That's actually technically, in economic terms, free money.
Yeah.
75% loan to value, 1.79%. Or if you've got 40% deposit, you could get 1.74%. So you can fix your mortgage if you've got a decent deposit below 2% for 5 years. And even if you've only got 10%, you can fix it below 2.5%. That is cheap money. And if you're paying more than that on your mortgage and you don't think you're going to move soon, go save yourself a couple of £100 a month and get a little bit richer.
Yeah. If your mortgage deal, your fixed rate, isn't coming up anytime soon, is there an argument that rates will be so low that you could probably afford, if you do the maths, to pay the fees of getting out? It's a hard one, isn't it? But then, or could you afford to wait maybe 6 months, a year? I mean, how?
What you need to do is you need to take a sort of educated guess at where you think mortgage rates will be at the point when your fixed rate deal would otherwise end. So therefore, what you could then lock into at that point, and then look at how much money that would effectively save you if you remortgage now instead, and how much it would cost you to get out of your mortgage. And mortgages can be pretty expensive to get out of. Early repayment charges are a real pain. And even when they step down, for example, if you're lucky, you get a 5% fix that steps down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Even 1% in that last year of the mortgage could be a couple of £1,000. And that can negate the gain that you're going to make. So basically what you need to do is get your piece of paper out and a pen.
Like you've done there.
Yeah, go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages and use some calculators and just try and work out whether you think you'll be better off. For most people, it's probably not worth paying their way out of a mortgage.
Rachel, I just want to ask, is this the final curtain on cheap mortgage deals?
I'd be such an idiot to answer that question because at so many different points we've said... The Bank of England has said, enjoy it while it lasts, rates are going to go up. We've thought so many times that it's going to happen, and we have heard phantom death knells so frequently of the end.
And as Simon's just proved, you can still get a reasonable deal out there.
And
so.
We just don't know. I mean, the interesting thing about the Bank of England report that was out last week and their many predecessors are that it's very hard to know what Brexit will do to the economy. But they still have to do their forecasts regardless of that. So what they do is that they assume that it's going to be roughly kind of OK, that we will have a smooth transition. We don't know whether that's true or not. And that adds another variable into the equation, that the forecasts at the best of times are a little bit interesting. But with Brexit thrown in as well, I mean, goodness knows what's going to happen. And so on current trends, yes, we could say that rates are going to go up. But we don't know whether, as Simon was saying earlier, it might be time for another recession. Tend to get them about every 7 years. So that's always a possibility. What Brexit will do... No idea.
Well, you have actually asked your good readers on your website, should the Bank of England raise interest rates in May 2018? Of over 550 votes, overwhelmingly the answer is yes, 78%.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I.
giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
Now, we're talking about housing, so I just wanted to ask your opinion on some research about home ownership that we got this week, showing the extent to which young people being locked out of the housing market. The Institute for Fiscal Studies saying the biggest fall in the last 20 years has been among middle-income 25 to 34-year-olds. I don't want to go into too much detail, but just explain to us what the Institute for Fiscal Studies are really saying. What is middle income? Is this all just down to house prices? Is it just a London thing?
No. So basically what they've done is they have looked at a cohort of people who would normally be expected to be first-time buyers, 25 to 34-year-olds, and middle income they have defined as earning between £22,200 and £30,600 per year. And what they have said is home ownership fell to just 27% amongst those people in 2016 from 65% two decades earlier. And I think that we can probably be reasonably safe in saying that this is not because those people have just decided that they don't want to own homes. It is because they basically can't afford them. Now, obviously, the crucial difference between 2016 and 20 years earlier, which is 1996, Oasis at Nebworth and all that, Britpop era, is that homes were quite cheap then. You had seen house prices go up lots in the 1980s, up into the early 1990s, and then they crashed. You had the recession then, you had the wave of repossessions, people losing their homes. And then they didn't really shift from that level. And 1996, 97 was pretty much the start of where the current housing boom came from. And at that point in time, houses were cheap. But actually, you can trace this line back all the way back from 1996, all the way, you know, through the 90s and the 80s into the 70s, 60s, and probably back to about the 50s when home ownership started to rise. And it will show you pretty much the same picture. Basically, it's a lot harder to buy a home now. People just can't raise the deposit. Mortgages are pretty cheap.
Yeah.
If you can basically get the mortgage, it's probably going to be cheaper than your rent for most people. It's raising a deposit.
But then haven't schemes like Help to Buy helped out?
Well, they have done if you want to buy a new build property, but also they've pushed up prices because you're giving people more money to buy houses, which you, if there's a gap in what they can afford and you just hand them some interest-free money to do that, you help drive up prices. Mm. And so we haven't really tackled the issue behind it, which is, one, there's an argument that we don't build enough homes, and two, people are, this whole thing is kept afloat by super low interest rates.
Rachel, we talk about generational gaps, but are we likely to see gaps within the younger generation? I'm thinking those who are going to get inheritance and those who aren't.
Yes, particularly in London. I've honestly no idea how you could buy a home purely through saving up from your wages. I'd be interested to see how many people have managed to do that. It is pretty much impossible. I mean, you need what? The average is 60 grand or something? I think is the average in London for a deposit. There's sort of no way round it. Starkest numbers, I think, in the report. Average house price has gone up between 1995 and 2015, went up 152%. Over the same period, incomes went up by 22%. There's no way around that gap. You can throw money at people, you can whatever scheme you like, but the widening of that gap over the last 20 years is what's kept people off the housing market. And you now have something like 38% of first-time buyer homes cost more than 10 times the average salary. I have just no idea how you would do that, apart from being given money, whether it be by government loans or by family inheritance, whatever it is.
And in the latest instalment of the Reasons to be Cheerful,
yes,
element of this podcast, first-time buyers are at their highest level for 11 years.
They are.
So things are getting better. More first-time buyers are finding themselves able to buy, and that is probably an element of cheap mortgage rates helping them out. Their parents definitely helping them out, but also the fact that house prices haven't necessarily been going up as much. And if we can stop house prices continually spiralling upwards and we can get people's wages to rise a bit, then we can probably get a few more of those people onto the housing ladder.
Well, let's stick with the optimism as well, because love was in the air this week, wasn't it? I'm not talking about Valentine's Day, load of old rubbish. No, we got plans to help out cohabiting couples. We often say on this show, don't we? There's no such thing as common law spouse when it comes to wills. But in life too, those who choose to live together, not get married, are often left a little hard done by current laws and policies. So is the government finally keeping up with the changing times? Ministers considering extending the financial perks of marriage to those who just live together. Rachel, what sort of perks are we talking about that you get as a married couple?
There's so much that you get. So there are tax benefits, benefits in terms of passing your tax-free allowance between you. There are implications for inheritance tax. So you can pass money between you without paying any tax, and you can lump your inheritance tax allowance together to pass on money to your family when you both pass away. All sorts of things. Brilliant being married. There's this myth that will not go away about common law marriage, that if you live together for long enough, if you own a home together, have children together, you might have or start to accrue certain benefits akin to your married counterparts. This is not true. There is nothing. And so it was a report this week by Royal London that said, not that government is considering giving these same rights to cohabiting couples, but there is a bill going through the House of Commons at the moment that is looking into allowing opposite sex couples to form civil partnerships. At the moment, there's this kind of strange imbalance whereby same sex and opposite sex can both get married, but same sex can have civil partnerships, whereas opposite sex cannot. And so this bill is looking at extending civil partnerships to opposite sex couples. People in civil partnerships have the same rights as people who are married. So the Royal London report says, well, what if this happened? What if civil partnerships were extended to opposite sex couples and they were therefore entitled to all of these same benefits? They perhaps slightly unfairly considered, well, what if everyone who cohabited decided to do it and form civil partnerships? What would the cost be? But the cost would be billions. The implications would be enormous, particularly if older cohabiting couples chose to enter into civil partnerships, then they would gain certain state benefit rights as well, which would cost the state billions. So it is a bit of a leap. It's a, if this happened and then that happened and then that happened, well, then lots of people might be entitled to more money and the cost of the state would be extraordinary. But it is kind of worth looking at.
Isn't it about time, though, that laws and policies and all that do start keeping up with the way that family structures are changing in this country?
I think so often it's a political decision based on the morality of many people who make those decisions and not on keeping up with people, with citizens and with families. And we saw that with the modernisation of the bereavement benefit system that did not make any kind of allowance for cohabiting couples, even those who have children together. So it would be nice, but I don't think it's going to happen for a long time.
All right, to love of each other, to love of something else, Simon. I'm talking cars, so I go straight to you. Drivers, good news keeps rolling, doesn't it? It really doesn't. Those who bought a brand new car from last April onwards, watch out, you're about to be hit with confusing new car tax rates that will see hikes for many popular motors. So in a couple of months, second year of ownership rules kick in. What's going on? What's changing? Why?
I must admit, after we did quite a bit on this last year when this new car tax system came in, I'd kind of filed it in the back of my mind and forgotten quite how stupid it is. There was a new car tax system brought in last year, and it's important to stress that this was only for brand new cars. So older cars, already registered cars, stayed on the old car tax system. Now, the way the car tax system works under this new system is the first year you have this higher rate of tax, which is basically called showroom tax. Everybody calls it that. And what that means is you pay a certain amount in the first year of owning the car. And that ranges from no money at all for cars that do not emit any CO2, so basically pure electric cars. Then it's £25 for cars that emit between 51 and 75 grams of CO2, which are basically pretty green cars. And then it goes up to £2,000 for the most polluting cars. So the first year, it's based on pollution. However, in the second year, you then, instead of moving to the current system, which is based on pollution, you move to a pretty much flat system. So if it doesn't emit any CO2 whatsoever, i.e. it's pure electric, you still pay nothing. If your car is a diesel or a petrol, you pay £140 a year, regardless of how polluting it is, versus the current system, which ranges between zero and 500 and something pounds. Or if it's a hybrid car, you pay a flat rate of 130. So after the first year of ownership, the car tax system completely detaches itself from the system in the first year of ownership and is no longer graded on emissions. So what previously happened was there was lots and lots of cars that could either pay very little or no car tax at all due to being greener, and now that is not the case. And the main winners in this are large polluting cars like the Ford Mustang, wonderful car that it is, but with a 5-litre V8 engine, its car tax falls from £535 a year to £140 now. There's also another completely bonkers element introduced, which is basically any car that costs more than £40,000 brand new has an extra charge applied for the first 5 years of ownership after the first year, right? So not the first 5 years of ownership, but years 2 to 6. And that extra charge is £310 per year. And that charge appears to have been brought in for the sole reason that if you buy an expensive car, you must be rich and that makes you bad. So you have this slightly bizarre system where if you buy a pure electric car, such as a Tesla that's more expensive, you are rewarded for this by paying no showroom tax, and you would continue to be rewarded for this by paying no car tax. But because it's expensive and therefore you must be bad, you pay £310 a year. It's an absolute dog's breakfast of a system that was cooked up by the former Chancellor George Osborne, introduced in April last year, and everyone went, this is completely crazy, we've forgotten how crazy this is. And now that the second year element is kicking in now, everybody's looking at it and going, oh wow, yeah, this is really crazy. Yeah, are we really still doing this? It's just completely insane.
Thank you very much, Simon. And finally, wherever you live in the UK, you are likely to have been affected by the recent cold spell. But are you setting your thermostat to a higher temperature than normal? Perhaps you're leaving the heating on low setting all day. If you are guilty of either of these, you could actually be wasting money and not making the slightest bit of difference to the temperature. So, Rachel, come on, debunk some common energy myths for us.
My favourite is that you shouldn't turn the heating up when it gets colder outside.
Yeah, what?
Yeah. It feels really counterintuitive, doesn't it?
That sounds like the new car tax system.
But just because it's cold outside doesn't mean that you want the temperature to be warmer inside, does it? You just want to be as warm as
it depends
consistently warm.
On so how good your house is at keeping in.
But it's supposed to sense
warm,
what it's supposed to sense what the temperature is, isn't it? And set it accordingly. I think that's ideal. And then the other one is that you're supposed to. I do this all the time. I get in and I'm freezing and the house is freezing and I whack up the thermostats to some obscene level because I think it'll get it warmer faster. And apparently this is not true.
No.
It doesn't warm up any faster putting it on a higher setting. You just put it on what you actually want it to be and it'll get there in the same time.
I know it's not house related, but it is warmth related. Is it true that you have to take off your coat inside to feel the benefit outside? How many times did I hear that as a youngster? Come on, someone give me the definitive answer.
Well, that would make logical sense because basically you are putting on more clothes when you go outside. And I suppose if there's an element of insulation there. But I guess what you want to do ideally is take your coat off inside, warm yourself up a little bit, then before you go out, put your coat on and wear it inside for a period of time. So you're nice, so you get too hot, you're nice and warm. The insulation keeps all of that warmth in and then go outside. So maybe the mistake you make is putting it on before you walk out the door.
Do you know what? I really want to know the answer to this because I get hassled for it all the time leaving my coat on inside because I'm going to get cold outside. But what I think is once you're cold, as far as I'm concerned, it's game over. You're going to stay cold. So if you go inside, it's not quite as warm, optimally warm as you'd like it to be. You take your coat off, you get cold. Once you go outside, it doesn't matter how many layers you put on, whether you put your coat on or another three, you're going to stay cold. So I think optimise the heat. Do whatever you can. But I would love to know the scientific explanation.
Please do send your answers to editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family and join in the conversation. Oh, and keep warm too.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.